Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Okay.
I'm from Atlanta, and we mind our manners. But it is my pleasure, and I guess you'll tell from my southern accent that I am really an Atlantan, but it's my pleasure to be here in our nation's capital. But most importantly, it's my pleasure to introduce a great panel to further the discussion that we had this morning. So I'm going to get right into it, and of course, their detailed biographies are located within your material, so I'll just be very brief in my introductions. Our first person to my left is Lisa Bates Moss. She's the president of Seedco Financial. Seedco is a national nonprofit community development financial institution, and it provides financing and business assistance to small business, among other activities. To her left is Jim Hammersley. He's the deputy assistant administrator at the Office of Policy and Strategic Planning in the U.S. Small Business Administration. He's responsible for evaluating the policy framework in the agency and also looking at developing some new programs. To his left is Don Graves. Don is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Small Business, Housing, and Community Development at the U.S. Department of Treasury. And he addresses a host of issues, including small business, to underserved and minority communities. Last but certainly not least is Javier Palomares. And he's the President and CEO of the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Now, this Chamber of Commerce represents well over 3 million Hispanic-owned businesses. So we'll, with our panel, I think we'll get a really great flavor of some of the challenges and opportunities that we have. So as the chairman mentioned and Sandy, the intent of this discussion is to really to better understand the impediments to small business finance, but from the nonprofit and government sector. So I'd like to just frame it by discussing a little bit about what we've learned so far, just to kind of kick things off. And these are some comments that you'll find reflected in the capstone draft document that we have. But just to frame the discussion, I'd like to just pull out a few of the issues that came about. Obviously, we're experiencing a higher demand for capital and credit. And there's stresses on availability, whether or not that's real or perceived, certainly has created a challenge for the profile of traditional borrowers. Programs, including SBA and others, may or may not be adequately addressing the needs of low and moderate income communities, as well as rural communities, which we had not yet talked about, as well as minority communities. There's more demand for small dollar loans, especially for entrepreneurs, and I think it'll be interesting for the panel for us to discuss what a small dollar loan is. I think that definition has changed somewhat. Some business types and industries have been completely shut out of small business credit. At least that's what that was among some of the findings that were shared with us. The network of technical assistance providers needs to be better linked to a broader range of lenders. And lastly, Administrator Mills just spoke about this, there's a bigger demand for small business to do business with government, whether or not it's local, state, or federal. So we definitely want to explore some of those. So the process will be very similar to what the previous panel was. I'll ask a question, and I'll have the panelists respond, and then I'll open it up to the audience, and then we'll move on to the next question. We're going to do this in pretty rapid fire so that we can make sure to capture many comments. And this comment is for both the panelists and for the audience, and that is, in addition to getting a better understanding of the challenges, we also want to focus on potential solutions so that we have some information to move forward with. I'm assisted today by Ruth Clevenger, who's my colleague from Cleveland. Now, Miami is in my district, and Ruth is from Cleveland, so we won't go there. Despite what you've heard on ESPN, we're working together. So I'll ask my panelists to be brief as well as the audience members. So the first question I want to dive right into, and I'm going to ask Lisa if you can really respond to this, and this has to do with coordination between traditional financial institutions and specialized small business credit and support service providers. I think you're well positioned to answer this. And this is at the regional meetings, we heard a lot of comments that there is a need for stronger collaboration between traditional financial institutions and community development lenders and support service providers. For example, and some of the meeting participants observed that better coordination between CDFIs and traditional lenders could help increase the number of qualified referrals to CDFIs, and I think the last discussion actually brought that out. Similarly, some meeting participants suggested that CDFIs and banks should do more to graduate qualified borrowers from one to the other. How would you characterize that level of coordination between traditional financial institutions and community development lenders and support service providers? And then secondly, really in your view, what more can be done, and not only what more can be done, but also by whom, to facilitate coordination between traditional financial institutions and small business lenders and community development lenders and technical assistance providers? So that's a mouthful.
That's a mouthful. So let me take a stab at sort of how I view the industry and how it operates today. And I can speak about this from my lens because I'm relatively new to the CDFI industry. Most of my background has been in the private sector. I've done a stint in government, mostly around financial services. So that is the linkage for me. And I would describe the current construct as being uneven at best. I think that some CDFIs have done a phenomenal job of creating those kind of deep relationships with a few of the lenders. I think where there is a gap is really not understanding fully what either side desires in the way of a productive relationship. And I think while we spend a lot of time having those conversations, they're best worked out, I have found, sitting in a room with a few people and actually going very deep into the discussion. So, for example, one of the things that we do at CECO Financial in working with our bank partners is that we really understand what are the issues they are facing, not only from a CRA perspective, but is there a real commitment to small businesses? And we want there to be a two-way dialogue and relationship in the sense that, A, we want to understand the profile that they are seeking with respect to the businesses that they lend to. And we heard a lot this morning about the lending criteria. Well, I was a former lender, so for me, having those conversations are very, very critical because it helps to shape and inform our strategy in working and partnering with the business, with the banks that fund us, quite frankly. And so I am very much in favor and encouraging those kinds of ongoing communications. Secondly, we spend a lot of time with our business owners. So we know what the businesses need, and we are in a unique position to communicate that back to our banks in a way that perhaps they may not fully appreciate and understand. So when we talk about working with a borrower, you know, it's really well beyond putting together financial statements and projections. And we understand that. And I also understand the dilemma that our banks face because they are in the business of generating volume. We are in the business of generating volume plus. And that plus around real technical assistance is critically important to the success and viability of those businesses. And so by that I mean, there are a lot of resources, both government and otherwise, that are available for pre-loan financing. Where we have found the biggest gap is on the post-financing side. And in order for businesses to grow and to be successful, the businesses we work with, we know need a very hands-on, high-level set of tools to help them grow. And it's not about inviting them in. It's about deploying resources out, because if you are a business owner and you're working 15, 18-hour days, you don't have time to show up at a forum or a workshop. And so we are committed to going out, deploying resources, and working very closely with those businesses. So I would say it has to be ongoing, consistent two-way communication to better understand the needs and the desired outcomes on all fronts. And secondly, there has to be a willingness to partner and to develop those relationships in a manner that there is a value proposition for all parties, because it has to be win-win. If it's not, it's just not going to work.
Okay.
Yeah, I just jump in there and say that I think that you are seeing a great deal more collaboration and coordination between CDFIs and traditional financial institutions, just because of the nature of the economy. I think that we've found that as a result of problems with banks being able to lend to certain types of borrowers, that there's automatically this move to CDFIs. I think the CDFI Fund in particular would welcome CDFI applicants who are applying for financial assistance and technical assistance awards, that as part of their application they identified new mechanisms and ways to work together more closely with financial institutions. But I think it's just the nature of the way things are going in with the economy and in the marketplace that you will find a great deal more collaboration between the two.
Okay. You both referenced this higher level of collaboration, and I know that there are a number of CDFIs in the room, even from my district, who I know are actually having to experience the same challenge. So are there some practical ways that you feel like, or relationships that you know have worked that might serve as models for us or for some of those CDFIs that may be looking to further and enhance their relationships with their bankers?
Sure. I think, one relationship that we developed late last year with a large financial institution, has gotten off to a great start in terms of really building a partnership. And there's a mutual respect. One is that while they play a role of funding partner, they have tremendous resources to bring to bear to assist us, leveraging their own expertise. And I think that's critically important. You know, everyone sort of, once you know your lane and you know what your strengths are, and being able to bring those resources, whether it's in the area of mentoring or whether it's in the area of providing sort of the trainer model, because there's a lot of expertise resident in the financial institutions that I would love to see the CDFIs also take more advantage of. So we have established regular communication meetings with the various staff, but also meeting around issues of the businesses that we are serving. We've now been able to develop some customized, either whether it's workshops or whether it's seminars that are very topically timely right now, particularly around not only accessing credit, but also having to do more with cash flow management, marketing, all of those kinds of services, and actually being able to do those things on site, because we work with banks that have branch locations and then those that don't. And so those that have branch locations have found it extraordinarily helpful that when we come into their branches, we can meet their customers that they have, in fact, have declined loans, and now they can introduce us as a partner. So those kinds of activities are going on a very frequent basis. The other thing that we have found that works is, again, we fill a niche. And so we're always looking at, if a bank doesn't lend to a particular industry, is this something that is important to the bank? We want to develop a solution to that, because that's created a gap in the marketplace. So we think that there, again, I can't stress enough, sometimes it's just going back to basics. If you don't really understand, the old principle of know your customer, we view our bank partners as our customers, we view our government partners as our customers, and that we have a responsibility to know our customers as well as we know our businesses.
Okay, I actually have a quick follow-up to that, and Lisa or someone else may be able to address that. And you speak about knowing your customers. One of the findings that came out in a number of the meetings was that the customer is changing. So the traditional bank customer may be a CFI customer or CDC or whatever. We had a discussion just recently in our bank with a microenterprise fund, and now they're seeing a new set of customers that they would have not formerly seen. So is that, are you experiencing that, or is that
Absolutely.
Pretty pervasive? And then what happens with that relationship? So that's kind of in today's environment, but how does that change? And does that create tension between a CDFI fund and a bank around a customer?
Increasingly, we are definitely seeing more demand from customers that, quite frankly, we otherwise would not have been lending to. And it is a trickle-down effect. It is causing us to also think very hard about our traditional base, because at the end of the day, we do think it's important to maximize the payment recovery on our loans. We want to make good loans. At the same time, we have a mission, and our mission is to foster local economic development in the communities that have traditionally not been served. And so it is a tension. There's no question about it. But I think it raises a bigger issue, because in this economic crisis, and I think we all have experienced it, this is every business has suffered over the last 2 years. And what we have found is that while our primary focus is on low-income and underserved markets, that there is such a growing demand for other services, for other types of borrowers, that is not being filled by any source right now. And so we are trying to balance that. More than 80% of the lending that we do focuses on low-income and underserved communities. But we also are cognizant of the fact that a lot of small businesses hire from low-income and underserved communities, and we think that it's important to also provide financing and lending services to them to the extent that we can.
Okay, thank you. Well, before I move on to the next questions, I'd like to ask the audience if they have any comments regarding any of what the panelists have said. Well, I know there are some CDFIs in the room from all of the time, so here's your opportunity.
Todd, if I could just add a bit on that. I know that there are a number of folks in the room and in the CDFI industry that are very focused on these issues. And, in fact, I think there are a number of examples of wonderful collaborations between industry and banks. I could point out my friend Frank Altman at the Community Reinvestment Fund, who has longtime expertise and experience in working very closely with banks. But I think there are industry groups like Opportunity Finance Network and the Community Development Bankers Association that have engaged in these direct types of discussions, trying to figure out ways that they can better serve their own mission of responding to the needs of low-income communities, but also working closely with financial institutions. And I think that you'll find, if I can steal from what Administrator Mills said earlier, stay tuned, because the Treasury and the CDFI Fund are also going to be working very closely with both banks and traditional CDFIs to try and find ways that we can strengthen those relationships.
Okay, thank you. Here and then here, and then back there, maybe. Won't forget about this slide.
My name is Ron Frazier. I'm the chairman of the BAC Funding Corporation, which is a CDFI multi-bank CDC out of Miami, Florida. I'm also a practicing architect for 40 years, so I've been a small business and run the gamut of everything that's been talked about in this conference. My question or comment is twofold. One is characterization. We often hear about Wall Street and Main Street, but there are a lot of supporting businesses that are on side streets and back streets. And I'm afraid in our conversation, these businesses are falling through the cracks because they are very small and they don't reach the lending thresholds or the profiles that a lot of banks look for. They don't come on the radar screen. But my big question is this. My understanding is that CDFIs came into being because they could mitigate circumstances and issues that banks could not in making loans. But when it turns around for the refunding, those very same banks and financial institutions put on their banking eyes, and they don't take into consideration those mitigation factors when they're reviewing those portfolios. Therefore, you have a catch-22 on that. They said, well, you know, look at these loans that you did. Well, look at the mitigating factors and the underwriting criteria that you institutions helped put together for us because you couldn't do it. And I think these are some things that are hindering CDFIs from getting refunded. So I'd like to see how they can respond to that second one. The first one is that we're becoming invisible.
So let me take a stab. So a couple things. One, I think we all realize that the CDFIs probably, in my opinion, play the most catalytic role in economic development. We are the bridge. We are the link. And you are absolutely right that the pressures are flowing down in many ways. And I would say to you, in response to sort of where we're lending, that is why our board for CECO Financial remains very, very focused on making sure that those small businesses don't fall through the cracks. But there is a continuum of credit even in the CDFI industry. So when we talk about CDFI, we have CDFIs that provide $500 up to $3,000. We have CDFIs that provide financing from $5,000 to $50,000, and then there's the $50,000 to $250,000, which is where CECO Financial operates. We think one way to sort of help ameliorate the situation is to invest alongside CDFIs who have a business model to make smaller investments so that we can spread the wealth, one. Two, we continue to support the efforts and activities of Treasury and the CDFI Fund by meeting with our elected officials and others to drive the point home of how important a funding source the CDFI Fund is to help us carry out the work that we do. But we all know that we don't have enough resources to meet all of the demands that are being placed upon us. And so we have to, I think, become more creative and innovative and bring these issues to the forefront. I've been very pleased to see the level of attention that we as an industry are getting because people, I think, are recognizing that we have filled a very important role during this economic crisis and that we really do not only know the communities in which we're serving, but that we have been at it, to your point, 25 years or more, and so we get it. And that dialogue has to continue, and the advocacy around it has to continue. From the lending perspective, in terms of banks re-upping, just in the short time that I have been in my role, I can tell you that CDFI lending sits in different places depending on what bank or you are raising your money from. And for many of them, you really now have the industry has become much more of a commodity. And so, yes, there are underwriting criteria that have to be met if you're being funded out of the commercial division within a bank. Some banks will keep it in community development and where there's a greater appreciation. And that's why I would go back to the point that I made earlier that, unfortunately, I think we do have to really understand sort of from the bank's perspective, how do we stack up relative to the other CDFIs or the portfolio? Because they are out there making decisions every day. And so the way we respond to that is execute, execute, execute. because we know at the end of the day, the more we can deploy that capital and work with the businesses that we know are contributing to the viability of our economy, both locally and nationally, that the performance matters. And so I think that that's vitally important.
Okay. Just one more quick comment, if you can keep things quickly moving, please. Right here, this gentleman. And then we'll have our next question, and we'll make sure to capture everyone's questions as we go along.
I'll try to be quick. Leslie, thank you very much. Roberto Barragan, BDC in Los Angeles. And you speak well to what our challenges have been. And at VDC in Los Angeles, and you can see from the earlier map that was said, show California at the center of this crisis. One of the things we have been actually, besides the incredible partnership that we have with the Small Business Administration, and frankly, I think SBA has bore the brunt of the small business issue for the past 2 years, and I hope Congress does, in fact, pass continuation on the fees, because we are both a CDC and SBA 7A lender through our credit union. One of the continuing challenges, beyond the SBA, there has been, I think, insufficient recognition by the federal government to small business lending by CDFIs. The fact is that most CDFIs across this country have been involved in many other things but small business lending, from affordable housing to multifamily housing, community, and those are all important things, but they don't address the current credit crisis. And the fact is there's been insufficient CDFI support and Treasury support to small business lending activities among CDFIs. And so, the fact is that I think you speak very clearly that we are a catalyst. We're not going to replace lost bank dollars. We're not going to replace that. When a bank moves away from small business lending, we can't even begin to take their place. But the fact is that we can be a catalyst in communities. We can fill the gap. We can be that link. And we can cause there to be additional resources in those communities. And so, I would encourage to see that we recognize that small business lending by itself is not the be-all, end-all of CDFIs that needs to be focused on singularly.
Okay. Thank you for your comment. I'm going to move on to the next question, and we noted in our discussion from panel one, and this, we heard comments from lots of meeting participants from all over, really, about some of the challenges specific to some of the SBA programs. And we also heard lots of great things. So when they work well, they really work well, and sometimes when they don't, I know that can be the source of frustration. And there's been differences around geography, around their utilization, et cetera. Jim, I wanted to ask you, in your view, what are some of the key barriers that have reduced the effectiveness of the SBA guarantee program, and then what are the top two to three things that can be done and by whom to improve their effectiveness? So that's really the first part of my question. And then the second part is, and this has to do with one of the suggestions that we heard in the meetings, is to give these CDFI loan funds greater access to making guaranteed loans under the SBA program, guarantee programs. And what is your view on this idea, and what steps are needed in order to effectuate this, and who needs to take those steps?
Okay, well, thank you. I want to thank the Fed for the invitation to participate today, Todd, and thank you for also saying we do good things. But let me give a short and long-term answer to your question. And the short-term answer, and sort of not to to flog an issue, but if you look at a graph of our production lately, it looks like the tooth of a saw. When we have money to pay the fee waivers and so on, volume goes up, stops, it goes down. It goes up, down, up, down. And one of the bankers mentioned earlier that that's difficult to manage from the banking side, and believe me, we understand that. It's also a bit of a challenge on the government side. And so resolving that issue, I think, would be a good first step in improving how the programs are doing today compared to, say, 3 to 6 weeks ago. But just to put a little more perspective around that, our volume this year in dollars, because of the money for the fee waivers and the guarantee, which, as Mrs. Mills mentioned, is not a lot of money relative to the volume of lending it's generated, it's up 74%. This time over this time last year, So you can see a very distinct cause and effect relationship. It's a really very easy to graph, and it matches right up. Any sort of statistical test you want to run, it's going to be there. But the other thing that I think really hasn't been focused on is the volume this year with the help of that stimulus money is about 10% over the 2008 volume. So it's not just, well, we've compared it to a very poor performing year and we look great this year. It's to the last year where things were the way whatever the old normal was, we're 10% ahead of that. So I think that in the short term, getting adequate funding for that is a key step. But looking a little bit longer term, there are a couple of things. The issue of complexity has been raised, and I would be the first to admit that we've got some complexities in our programs that are not going to be part of conventional bank lending. For example, we require a name check, a character check. It's in our statute, and I think as taxpayers, none of us want the government supporting loans to people that are not of good character. I'm not sitting here and saying that your customers are not of good character. I'm just saying we have a little bit extra step to go through that a conventional lender might not do. The other things, you know, silly as it might sound, but you have to determine that a business is, in fact, small for it to be eligible for small business lending. And most bankers, when a customer walks in, they don't ask themselves that question, is this customer big or small? I mean, maybe it depends on how much money they're looking for, whether they talk to this unit within the bank or that unit within the bank. But nobody has to pull out 13 CFR 121 and look at any number of NAICS codes and start figuring out whether a borrower is big or small. There's other issues, too, whether the loan proceeds meet our criteria. We recognize that complexity is out there, and so what we need to do is make an effort to determine whether technology can step in or whether some of these issues can be simplified in other means. One of the other issues we've been dealing with, quite frankly, is the reputation on our guarantee. A couple of years ago, we made a change to the process, and as occasionally happens when there's a change, the change did not go as well as we had hoped. And it was taking up to 270 days for us to pay on a guarantee. Well, if you're a banker, you don't want to hear that you're going to have to wait 9 months to get paid. Now, we have solved that problem, and most of the payments are made under 30 days. The bulk of claims are handled very quickly, very professionally, very expeditiously. But anyone that's dealt with reputational issues in the room knows that it's easy to lose a good reputation and very hard to get it back. And so we're still kind of in the getting it back category. The other issue that we deal with on a regular basis is just the information issue. And a classic case was today's Sam's Club announcement, or yesterday's Sam's Club announcement. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I know more than one person thought the SBA and Sam's Club were partnering for something. Well, in fact, one of our lenders and Sam's Club are partnering, and I think that's a great thing. But the point of that is the information gets out there, and it's easily misunderstood. And so we need to deal with that and get our story out to lenders. Now, to the next part of your question, what are the action items that we can do to start moving forward on that? I think some of them kind of jump out at you from the question. But Administrator Mills, one of the first things she did when she came on board was created something aptly titled the Simplicity Task Force, or Simplification Task Force, I'm sorry. And, you know, she's a very straightforward manager. You have a problem, you attack the problem head on. And so what we did was our Office of Field Operations polled our staff to look for suggestions. And these are folks that in many cases have made SBA loans either in a prior career with a bank, when we processed loans in the field, but they talked to our customer base every day, not only the borrowers, but also the lenders. They had lots of good suggestions on how to make the process simpler. So we've split the suggestions into kind of a short, medium, and long-term goal, and Mrs. Mills had said, listen, we're in this for the long term, so you know, give me a plan for each of those. I want to see the long-term as well as the short-term goals addressed. So we're moving forward on that. We're also, like a lot of folks, striving to provide a more consistent direction. I mean, more than one of the bankers earlier said, sort of just, and these are my words, tell me what you want me to do. So we have, a couple of years ago, we rewrote our loan guidance on processing, and we made a commitment to the industry to, within reason, only update it once a year rather than changing it on a random basis. I've occasionally mentioned in speeches that under our old system, you had to wake up every morning and ask yourself the question, did SBA change anything yesterday? I'm betting that's not the first thing you think about every morning. And so, barring some sort of major issue, we've made a commitment to our industry to just update the guidance once a year, you know, unless something comes up. We're working on the guidance on liquidation and servicing to be set in the same mode. So again, to get to the consistency issue, ease of use, and learning an issue. We need to continue with our outreach efforts, and we have actually stepped them up in the last several months. We did a presentation with the folks here at the Federal Reserve aimed at their field examiners. And their mission, their interest in this, was to get information to their examiners about the SBA program so that when they see SBA loans on the books of the banks, they can get a better understanding of what they're looking at. Our interest was, and we were very straightforward about this to the field examination staff, is that if you see a bank that you can see where they're dropping some of their customers because the customer's credit has become a little bit of a challenge, whatever issue there is, think about using the SBA program to keep that customer going forward. Again, we don't typically think of field examiners as an outreach group, but they're right there in the bank and a good source of information. We've also been working with the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Some of you probably met Barry Whitus here earlier. Barry's staff has been very helpful in putting out information to the national banks, which has been picked up all over the place on both of our 7A and 504 programs. Again, they're trying to get the word out because even though banks are fairly stable, you know, people know banks that have been around 100 years, the workforce in any industry changes regularly. So we may get someone trained and they do a good job in the SBA program and they get promoted. And then we start over training another person. There's a couple of other issues that Administrator Mills mentioned that I'll just touch on ever so briefly is raising the loan size. Large companies are big job generators. If any of you saw the articles in Business Week last week about that, there were some interesting articles about manufacturing and creating manufacturing jobs, and that the higher ceiling would be good for that. And the administrator also mentioned the ability to temporarily refinance real estate loans that are out there. Every banker in this room has real estate loans in their portfolio that were made 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and have a reset coming up. And the collateral isn't worth what it was before. And so that puts you in a dilemma. And then finally, it's on this particular issue, we are looking at how to use technology as efficiently as possible. In a perfect world, and we don't live in this world, but in a perfect world, I, as a commercial loan officer in a bank, would be able to go on a web application and just work my way through it. And at the end of the application, you know, the credit skills would be the banks, but coming out of this would be an SBA loan authorization that met the criteria. We have looked at that. There's work going on it. There's some outside work being done on it. We would never be able to do something that would get 100% just because in the gray area of the 5% of borrowers that are always a little bit on the line, the number of questions you'd have in a web app would put anyone to sleep. But that said, we should be able to get 50, 60, 70% of small businesses taken care of. So that's kind of the summary on that issue. Okay. To get to the CDFI issue, that is something that we have a very great interest in. I mean, clearly the CDFIs reach a constituent base that melds tremendously with our mission. And so we've had some initial conversations with that. We've done actually on that issue, we've done a lot of internal research on the issue, and you know, to echo Don's comment a minute ago, stay tuned on this one because we see a lot of, to use the old phrase, a lot of synergy here between the goals of a lot of us on this platform and others in terms of getting financial services to those folks that haven't necessarily traditionally been able to access the private banking community.
Okay. I want to dig a little deeper on this whole issue around gaps and credit gaps. I know you mentioned that You guys have this jagged edge based upon your funding. And Don, this really is a question I'd like for you to take a stab at. And at the regional meetings, we heard from meeting participants that demand from credit-worthy small business borrowers still exceeds available lending capital for certain types of loans. Where credit gaps exist, such as working capital, lines of credit, and loans of less than $200,000, and that was a really big issue. Startup capital and patient capital to assist with financing equipment and other large purchases. Still, we heard pretty consistently that there are major gaps in that area. But what do you believe are the key credit gaps for credit-worthy small businesses, and what steps can be taken and by whom to make additional capital available to help close some of these gaps? I know that's a big question. And then the second part of that would be, in particular, what additional steps should be taken to help the demand for small business capital on the part of nonprofits and non-regulated CDFIs and others who are attempting to play in this space?
Sure. I think what the Federal Reserve is hearing is the same thing that we've been hearing and that folks all around this room and around the country are hearing, that there are there are significant credit gaps for small businesses, for underserved communities, for mainstream communities. We've just gone through taking the largest economic hit this country has seen in more than 60 years. So we're seeing the problems, the gaps in working capital, the lines of credit, small business loans, the startup and patient capital, and so on. In addition, one thing that you didn't mention that I think people around the country are beginning to see are the problems with commercial real estate loans. There are some balloon notes coming due pretty soon at the same time that real estate values and business revenues are coming down. So that's another issue that we've been paying attention to. The administration and Treasury in particular have been very focused on trying to find ways to stabilize the financial markets and ensure that that our system is able to meet the credit needs of the country going forward. And I think that with the capital purchase program as part of the TARP and the other Recovery Act programs, we actually have gotten to the point where we've stabilized the economy and we're beginning to see the signs of growth. That said, as Administrator Mills mentioned, we have several proposals that we believe will help to drive will help to get at those credit gaps that we've been seeing around the country. And Treasury's been looking at this through a sort of a multifaceted approach. One is the president's proposal for proposals for small business lending. First would be the Small Business Lending Fund, which, as Administrator Mills mentioned, is a $30 billion proposal to provide capital to small and community banks around the country. These banks are, if you look at the average community bank, 70% of their lending portfolio goes to these types of businesses. They're small loans under $1 million. So these are the right banks to stabilize, and we expect that with the incentives that are part of that program, we'll see a great deal of lending to small businesses as a result. The proposal has been supported by the Independent Community Bankers Association, the National Bankers Association, the Conference of State Banking Supervisors, and so on and so forth. So we believe that proposal in itself will go a long way to meeting the needs of communities. And in fact, not only is it separate from TARP, but it over the long term, over 10 years, it'll save the American taxpayer over $1 billion. So it'll increase lending and save money for the American taxpayer. A second proposal that's part of the small business legislation that the administrator did not mention, but the administration is very focused on passage, is a $2 billion state option. The State Small Business Credit Initiative will provide $2 billion in direct grants for state innovative credit programs. There are a great deal of innovative programs around the country that have been very successful. But because of the fiscal problems that a lot of the states have been facing over the past year or so, they're not able to continue to fund those innovative, successful programs. What the president has proposed is providing direct grants to those states that they can continue to strengthen and support those very successful programs. As part of that program, we are requiring a match, or we're requiring that each of those programs leverage $10 for every $10 in private lending for every $1 of federal contribution. So with $2 billion, you would expect that at a minimum, those programs would provide $20 billion worth of lending to small businesses. Just to take an example of what those types of programs can support, capital access programs, which nearly 30 states in the country are operating right now, are able to, we've seen historically, have been very successful in getting at those parts of the marketplace that a lot of the traditional financial institutions have not been able to get at. And in fact, they've been very successful in leveraging those small amounts of state funds into increased lending, somewhere between 20 and 30 to 1, depending on the state. So we expect that those programs will go a long way to getting at the credit needs of communities. One other part of the Small Business Lending Fund that gets at the issue raised by the gentleman from California just a moment ago is that both the House and Senate versions of the bill have a provision providing for about $300 million in support for CDFI loan funds, and we expect that will also go a long way in helping CDFIs meet the needs of these underserved communities. And while I'm on that, I also want to say that the administration and Treasury are very supportive of the work that CDFIs do in getting at the needs of those underserved communities. And in fact, the president's budget for FY10 and FY11 have an increase of about 130% over what we saw in the previous administration. It's about a $250 million budget for the CDFI fund. And in fact, in 2009-2010, there were about $275 million in financial and technical assistance awards, which was more than the 6 years combined in the previous administration. So we believe that there are a number of ways that we can support the meeting the credit needs of many of these communities. And the last thing that I'll touch on is it's something that it was a question that was asked of the administrator in during her speech, was around New Markets Tax Credit Program. Treasury is working very closely with the IRS and other friends, both in the administration and in communities, to try and find ways to revamp regulations so that the New Markets Tax Credit Program will actually meet the needs of small businesses. We know that it's been a problem in the past to utilize the New Markets Tax Credit. The way that the investments work, the life cycle of those investments don't necessarily meet up with the 7-year term of the New Markets Tax Credit. So we are working very closely with IRS to try and change those rules so that they work for communities.
Okay, I actually want to flip the coin just a moment on what you've just discussed to ask you a little bit about another issue that we heard in our meetings, and that has to do with CDFI capacity, that even if these programs were initiated tomorrow, for example, because of economic conditions and layoffs of staff and then basic capacity that exists that may have existed anyway, what are your perceptions around CDFI capacity? Because we are hearing mixed stories in some communities. They're saying that we have plenty of capacity, we just need more money. And then others are saying that we lack the technical capacity in order to get this money out on the street. And particularly in the most vulnerable communities, are we hearing that? So I wanted to get your perceptions on that.
Can I make a comment? My name is Javier Palomares, and I represent the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. And I'm sure most of you know the three agencies that are here with us, but in case you don't know about our organization, we represent about 3 million Hispanic-owned businesses in the United States and Puerto Rico. And they run the gamut from virtual startups to multi-billion dollars in revenue every year. We advocate on behalf of these businesses, and we do so through a network of about 210 chambers throughout the United States. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the Federal Reserve and thank you for the effort. I'd like to acknowledge and thank the SBA not only for the effort but for the results, the innovative approach that the SBA has taken, and what you've done to help America's small businesses is very much appreciated. And specifically, Administrator Mills and her no-nonsense way of attacking the issue or the issues, and her commitment to stay focused on the communities of need is heartfelt, and we very much appreciate. I would say that we've talked quite a bit about CDFIs, and while I think that certainly I agree with Ms. Bates-Moss that CDFIs are very much the fabric of the communities they serve, and perhaps no other institution out there understands the needs of small businesses because they are part of that community. They understand the issues, the challenges, and oftentimes are not only the administrator of the loan, but become the business consultant on an ongoing basis. And if the business makes it, oftentimes it's because the CDFI held their hand, and I commend that. That said, I would say that of about the 800 CDFIs in this country, there's only three that are Hispanic-based or Hispanic-backed or managed by Hispanics. And yet when you look at the growth of small business in America, Hispanic small business outpaces all others at a rate of about 4-1. And when you look at women-owned Hispanic businesses, they outpace the rate of growth and startup at a rate of about 6-1. So there's a huge gap in the Hispanic community as it relates to the needs for Hispanic-owned, managed, and focused CDFIs. And I hope that somebody can help the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce to ease that need. I would say that the SBA programs have been unbelievably effective, and we thank the SBA for their efforts. By way of example, just one very concrete example, in El Paso, Texas, of all places, there is a Women's Border Business Center that is run there by our local chamber. That business center, that Women's Business Center, has been the highest performing women's business center in the country for the last 10 years. And when I called their leader, Cindy Ramos Davidson, who has been running that chamber for some time, and asked her, of all places, why El Paso? I mean, New York certainly has women in businesses, and so does San Francisco and L.A. and so many other metropolitan areas. And she boiled it down to a few things. She said it was the communication, the coordination, and the consultation she gets from the CDFIs there and from the SBA. And she said that in the last 12 months, it's gotten even better. So as it relates to what's going on in the marketplace, we are practitioners. We're not an administration. We're not a group that theorizes in this stuff. We see it every day. In fact, I'll be on the phone today with about 14 other chambers throughout the country to talk about the challenges we're facing. All of that to tell you that we very much appreciate the opportunity to participate, but we hope that this group will take a keen interest in the needs of the America's Hispanic-owned businesses throughout the United States.
Okay, thank you. Well, I know a number of you came up to me over the break, and I tried to get in your questions as best as we could, but I'd like to hear from the audience with respect to questions or comments with the panelists have said. So why don't we start with you?
Good afternoon. Thank you for your comments. Selma Taylor, Executive Director of CARAT, California Resources and Training. My question has to do with technical assistance. And I think that in this era, there's a new role for technical assistance. The profiles of the businesses are different, and the profile of lending is different. And so I'm trying to find out who is funding technical assistance. I know that there are lenders who fund loan pools, but they don't fund the technical assistance. So can anyone respond to that?
Can I take a briefly answer some of that? So, that's a big question.
Well,
this is like finding the needle in the haystack in this market environment. Let me just put it like that. When you think about our funding model, which is loan capital, loan loss reserve, and operating support, and very little attention is being focused on the technical assistance, to your point. And I think what has resulted is that most of the focus has been on the small business development centers, which have been obviously a tremendous asset, and a lot of municipalities have their own. So a lot of them are government-funded. And so what has been happening is that I think the CDFIs have primarily just been sort of either participating in those directly or just partnering and collaborating with those institutions. We were very fortunate in 2009 to launch a very important partnership with Goldman Sachs. And in that regard, they have been very supportive of post-loan financing assistance being provided to businesses. We also are seeing more interest by some foundations in this area. But I think to your point about really thinking about this differently than way we have in the past is really important. Businesses, I mean, I can't tell you some of the heartfelt stories that I get from businesses. They want the help. They need the help. But what they are also saying to us is that, okay, you've shown me how to package and get a loan, but now I'm running into problems. How do I manage my business in this kind of economic environment? And quite frankly, some of the borrowers have even gone as far as saying to us, we will fund it because they really need it that badly. And so we are constantly out driving the point home that post-financing assistance, that hands-on, that's, you know, when I run into problems, we didn't hear about sort of how do you help the business. So, for example, yes, we know that a lot of our businesses have not had cash flows in the last 2 years, right? Well, we've never really looked at historical cash flows from where we sit. It's always been unprojected. While we implement those kinds of lending criteria, we are also cognizant of the fact that there is potential for that business. And so what we will do is we will structure those loans in a way that will help that borrower while at the same time minimize our exposure. First-time borrower with us, you know, got a great business model, you've got that contract in hand or purchase order. So I can't put all the money out the door to you up front, but what I will do is, you know, if you meet the criteria, we can finance you, make the commitment for $100,000, for example, but maybe what we do is we disperse on a quarterly basis to see what your track record is and work with you in terms of repayment. The minute that we find that there's a problem, then we are on the phone with you trying to figure out what's going on. And if we have to restructure, it gives us both ample time to do that. So who's funding it? On the post-financing side, we have seen very little way in funding. What we are hoping is that some of our government resources can be shifted to do more post-loan financing support. But we are also looking to our foundation partners. We're looking to our bank funders. And we also want the borrowers to participate in this because at the end of the day, you know, and my staff knows I always make this comment, if you feed a man a fish, he'll eat for a day. If you teach him, he'll eat for a lifetime. So we are very much about giving our businesses a hand up and want them to participate in this process because at the end of the day, we can do all of this, but if they don't take this and then move it to the next level, then we have failed. And so we're looking at models where everybody has to have some skin in the game. And by the way, there are a lot of vendors and consultants and professional service providers out there who are graciously contributing some of their time pro bono So that's why I said having a model where everyone is participating, I think, is the best model long term.
Todd, if I could piggyback on that. Again, Ms. Moss Green, I couldn't agree more. Bates Moss, I couldn't agree more.
That's okay. You can turn her.
I don't know what happened there. But it's funny you mentioned Goldman Sachs because I sit on the advisory panel for the 10,000 Small Businesses Initiative. Along with Chairman and CEO Lloyd Blankfein and Warren Buffett. The 10,000 Small Businesses Initiative, I would encourage you to look into it, is an initiative where Goldman Sachs is dedicating $500 million that they are investing directly into America's small businesses in communities of need. And to the extent that it makes the funding available in and of itself at a time like this where they're cutting through the red tape is phenomenal. But above and beyond that, to your point, they focus as well on the post-funding technical assistance that's needed by these small businesses, and they're working through local community colleges to administer that training. And it runs the gamut from marketing to managing your financials to building a business plan to, you know, governance and business management. Those are critical needs of America's small businesses today, and nobody is, addressing that at a level at which this organization, Goldman Sachs, appears to be wanting to do so. It's a real model for innovative thinking and how you get at the heart of the issue at a time when it's needed the most. I'd encourage you to look into it.
Okay. Thank you. And I know that we
If I could just add one thing, I apologize for this, but this is just too good of a setup for SCORE. For those of you not familiar with SCORE, It goes by the acronym SCORE. It was originally came on a service corps of retired executives, but it is specifically designed, in effect, for this type of consulting. After someone has a loan, any time in the life cycle of the business, the SCORE volunteers typically have experience in the line of work, a florist, a dry cleaner, and in many cases can provide hands-on experience based on their experience.
Yeah, it is a great program. And I do want to get to as many questions as possible, so I'm going to encourage both the audience member as well as the panelists to be brief so we can get to as many comments. And I know you've been waiting patiently.
Jean Horsemouth with Interise. Can I also make a plug for the Emerging 200 Initiative, which the SBA funds?
Absolutely.
And is was, as ourself at Interise, an inspiration for the Goldman Sachs initiative. My question, it's more a very quick fact. We believe it's skin in the game, and we charge $3,000 a year. People pay it, they finish, and they tell us it's too little. The problem is what we actually cost for our program, and the SBA program costs the same if it was fully charged, is about $8,000. And there has to be some way in which that gap is made up. The entrepreneur can put skin in the game, but we really do need some major corporations to step up and not create their own initiative and fund their own people to duplicate, but to really invest in the existing network of technical assistance providers specifically focused on the businesses creating the most jobs.
Thank you. I think that there was a question or comment over here.
I have a question.
Okay, please.
Betsy Zeidman from the Milken Institute. And again, thank you. These have been great discussions. It's interesting, you know, the first panel was about the private sector. The second panel is about the public sector. And clearly, there's not enough money in the public sector to solve this problem. There's definitely not enough money in the nonprofit sector to solve this problem. And there isn't enough sort of market mechanism in the private sector to do it because they'd be in there doing it. We wouldn't have to be spending our time here talking about it. So, well, the Milken Institute, along with the Calvert Foundation and my colleague Wayne Silvius here and a number of other groups, have been working on an idea of a public-private partnership that would marry a couple of these forces and enable the government to do what the government can do well, which is provide some downside risk mitigation, be an enabler, to then enable the private sector to do what it does well, which is do markets. And so if the government could help make markets work, so this is called the Entrepreneurial Impact Facility, and the idea is it would be a type of a public-private partnership that would direct money to funds that invest in high-growth small businesses that are job creators and are particularly in sectors that where we have seen that there are market gaps, environmental technologies and services, minority-owned businesses, low-income communities, healthy food, areas that are sustainable, high-growth, contribute to the quality of the jobs and the quality of lifestyles, but also have real market potential to market growth. So thinking about these types of things, I think, would be very helpful in thinking about this as we start to think about solutions.
Thank you. And why don't we go over to that lady right there.
Hi, I'm Toni Simons, and I work for the California Legislature. I'm the policy consultant that does the access to capital and small business issues. It sounds like what we're talking about is moving from a case study best practice to really looking at a debt equity model, a modern debt equity model that reflects really a range of the financial needs of businesses. So what I'm wondering is a couple things. I'm wondering is how do we use the different resources that are in the room to not just meet the needs of small businesses as we get there, but actually start to categorize, collect the information to put this broader model in place. Because part of the challenge is, as the woman that just spoke, that the fee may be $3,000, but her real costs are $8,000. Coming from a legislature who hates to pay administrative costs, even when we tell them if you don't pay those costs, you can't get your output, it seems that if we had a broader model that kind of included all those things, that we might be able to go after more of the public money because they would be able to talk about how many jobs did you create by providing this, the supplemental between 3,000 and 8. So the question again is, how do we move forward to a more modern debt equity model in the same time that we're actually trying to meet small business needs today?
Part of the issue, I think, that you raise, and it's a good point, is that, as Administrator Mills mentioned, specifically related to SBA, is the lack of information more broadly. And I think that one of the things that the administration is in discussions right now on is doing a better job of mapping resources in communities, collecting the appropriate data to understand just the sorts of things that you're raising, that, you know, part of what we may be doing with one program is meeting the needs of in a certain niche, but there's another broader set of needs that if we were able to fill that niche, we'd actually be able to get to to leverage those resources, you know, by a number of multiples. So I think part of it is that, and part of it is the types of things that we've been having discussions with folks like Betsy and Wayne at Milken and Calvert and others to talk about ways to leverage the resources, leverage the federal government's resources, commitments, bully pulpit, what have you, to get investors from the private marketplace invested in those areas where there are real problems, and we might be able to really jumpstart some things. So I think that's a great point, and I think it just highlights the need for better data collection and a better understanding of what's working and what's not working.
Okay. I think there was a gentleman over there, two people over.
Good afternoon. Victor Galloway with the North Carolina Institute of Minority Economic Development. I want to applaud the efforts by all the regulatory agency as well as the CDFIs for the work, but I'm very cautious about celebrating based on the data that we know. There has already been a credit gap, particularly in the underserved and underutilized community before the crisis, and there are even a more credit gap now as well as access to capital. And then an initiative that we talked about, I have a concern, and I want to know what are the strategies to bring those communities up to par, whether it's the African-American community or the Hispanic community, as well as with the funding that we're going to fund lenders who already had an issue with providing access to capital and credit to those communities in the first place. So what strategies do we have in the current strategies that we talked about that will ensure transparency to make sure that the money is actually reaching the community equally and accessibly?
So is this more of an equity question?
It's more of a access equally to credit and capital, not so more as equity. We talked about in the strategies as far as the Small Business Lending Fund to provide liquidity to small businesses, as well as creating a program to reduce the credit gap. But there was a gap in underutilized and underserved communities before.
Sure.
And so what I'm saying now is that going forward with these new programs, what transparency are being put in place within the strategies to make sure that those gaps don't continue to widen?
I'll take the first crack, and maybe someone else will jump in as well. I think that you're exactly right. These gaps have existed for a lot longer than the folks on the panel have been working in our respective roles. I think part of the answer, again, is understanding the reasons for those gaps. It's a little bit of an information issue and where things have worked and where things have not worked. But it's also, at least from the government perspective, it's a matter of using what we have in place already better. And not to put him not to put him in the wrong place at the wrong time, but my colleague Dr. Ed Montgomery with the White House Council on Auto Communities, that's a type of approach that the president and the administration are very focused on, finding new ways to leverage existing programs around government and new programs to focus on the issues of specific communities that have been hard hit or even more hard hit as a result of the economic downturn. So I think it's a matter of us figuring out ways to better leverage our existing resources and not have, for instance, I'll just pick one thing that we are working on. CDFIs do not fully utilize the SBA's 504 and 7A programs, and that's something that I think will go a long way to getting at the needs of those hard-hit, underserved communities. And it's not something that we've spent a lot of time on previously, but it's something that this administration is very focused on doing. So that's the type of approach that I think will be important. But there's too much to do to rest on our laurels and celebrate what we've already done. And I think having you and your colleagues from around the country and here in this room to continue to raise the issues of and problems facing underserved communities is vitally important.
Okay. One more brief question or comment. Al?
Thank you. My question is it's a question, and I like to preface it by saying that my question is not race-based, but is purely 100% economic-based. And a case in point, I'm from the chair of FMCRC out of Florida, based in Tampa. And in Florida, in our urban centers, minorities account for over 42% of the population, but only contribute less than 5% of the GDP, which obviously impacts our entire economy, both regionally and nationally. You know, my questions are more geared toward shifting policy that would increase the GDP contribution of these emerging markets and market segments that obviously allow them to consume at a greater rate and, i.e., buy more cars, more homes, you know, go to restaurants, et cetera, et cetera. The first one that actually has to do a little bit with the gentleman over there was alluding with regard to transparency. I would ask one of the panelists to talk about whether they're in favor and think that overturning Reg B that would require race and gender data to be reported by financial institutions would actually increase the accountability of these institutions by obviously increased transparency. In other words, we know who they're lending to. And two, which has indirectly to do with that, are you in favor of overturning or overhauling the CRA so that it is more job-based and more small business lending-based? In other words, you know, an old boss of mine used to tell me the best affordable housing project he ever seen was a good-paying job. So are you in favor of creating, you know, more applicability in CRA where the banks get more credit for small business lending?
Okay, great questions. Brief answers.
I'll start with that since I have a little experience with that. SBA has collected race data for as long as I've been there, which is quite a while, and it's collected on a voluntary basis, but the sample is large enough that I think that the data is very good. We use this data for marketing focusing and reaching out to specific communities if we see an issue within a particular community. So as far as running a government loan program, because that's my area to speak to today here, is we've collected this information for a number of years and have found it very useful in targeting our marketing and other outreach efforts.
Okay, thanks.
And I'll just follow up on the second part of that question. I think that as most folks in this room probably know, the federal banking regulators are in the process of holding a series of hearings around the country on the Community Reinvestment Act and whether or not there is a need for reform or change in the program. So I don't mean to put you off on this, but I think that we'd like to wait and hear what happens at these hearings, hear from folks around the country. I think that your overall point is well taken, that we need to find ways at getting at underlying economic growth first and foremost, and that's part of the reason that we've not to harp on this, part of the reason that we've been that the president has proposed his Small Business Lending Fund and the State Small Business Credit Initiative and the other SBA programs, because I think if we are able to get the economy going again, get small businesses moving and employing people, that in the end, all of our communities will see some growth.
Just a couple of quick things, because I want to make sure I address sort of both of you, your points. You asked about sort of how do we ensure that there are efforts or steps being made to sort of close gaps going forward. A couple things. One, even with, and while I certainly am supportive of the Small Business Loan Fund, and I think that's vitally important, I think a real piece that's missing from that is around supporting technical and business assistance. I think the same exists within, it's easy, relatively easy, quite frankly, to go raise loan capital. It's very difficult to raise the operating money to support the work to improve the quality and the performance of the loans. So what I would love to see, whether it's in CRA or some other mechanism, is that there will be more formal linkages where there is funding available for that. But I think what gets to that is data. When I first came in, the first thing I asked was, how much does it cost to originate a loan? And while I don't have as fully fleshed out data as I'd like, I can tell you that when we did the analysis on our own portfolio, it's anywhere between $2,500 and $10,000 a loan, and for a small loan. Now, when you heard all of the conversation today earlier about automated credit scoring, well, you take out a huge part of that cost when you move to that model, but we all know that we are manually underwriting these loans. So that's probably on the low end. So I think data is a starting point to even demonstrate what it costs, what those gaps are that we're talking about, and that this is where I think government as the enabler can be very instrumental in helping to close that gap with the resources that it has available as almost a backstop. And I think, quite frankly, and we all would agree, thank goodness for the CDFI fund, because financial and technical assistance award really serves as a backstop to the work that we do. Without it, this model would not work.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, and we're going to get to the data. Sandy, go ahead.
Yeah,
please.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to answer the first part of Al's question about the Reg B piece of it. The current legislation that's making its way through Congress includes provisions that would do exactly what you're talking about, would mandate the collection of small business data, race, gender data, for small businesses. That is in the current regulatory reform legislation.
Thanks, Sandy, for clarifying that. We're going to go into our speed round, and that is, I know this has been really hard with this panel, but we're going to make it work. And that is, based on your work on small business lending, what do you believe is the most promising one change that could be made? So if you had a magic wand, what one change would you make? And if you could just say what that change is, and we can capture or imagine how that might work out, but just if you could share with us what that would be and who needs to make that change. So why don't we start with you, Javier?
Well, I would say that I would encourage the SBA and CDFI fund to work together and allow CDFIs to make loans under the SBA guarantee program, if I had to say one thing quickly.
Okay, thank you.
How'd I do?
Great. Perfect.
Being a native Clevelander, I won't say that changing LeBron's decision would make a difference in small business lending, even though I would be for it.
It might.
That's true. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I would focus on the improvement of data collection and information, because I think it'll have a profound impact on our ability to show that there's a value in investing in certain ways and communities.
Great. Thank you.
Robin Preger mentioned a pendulum. I've never seen a pendulum swing too far and then just go right back to the middle. So anything that encourages banks to lend to small businesses, which include the SBLF, funding the fee waivers and so on, anything like that, I think is what we need to do to jumpstart lending.
Okay. Thank you.
I yield over the balance of my time.
I would certainly expand capital, available capital in the three areas that we talked about, not only affordable and flexible financing terms for us as an industry, but really having the associated financial support to deliver high-quality technical assistance and so that we can actually become self-sustaining as an industry.
Okay. Thank you, panel. Please join me in thanking our great panel.